Hello, and welcome back to Plantopia. Plantopia is the plant health podcast of the American Phytopathological Society, and I'm your host, Matt Kasson. I'm an associate professor of forest pathology and mycology at West Virginia University. This is the fourth episode of season four of Plantopia, and today I'm excited to speak with Dr. Romina Gazis, associate professor of plant pathology and director of plant diagnostic clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at the Tropical Research and Education Center at the University of Florida. She is a plant pathologist extension specialist for tropical fruits, ornamentals, and landscape crops. Dr. Gazis completed a BS in biology at Ricardo Palma University in Peru, a Master's of Science in Environmental Sciences from Texas Christian University, and a PhD in Plant Sciences from the University of Maryland. Dr. Gazis completed her postdoctoral work in fungal genomics and evolutionary biology at Clark University from 2012 to 2015, and a second postdoc in forest pathology at the University of Tennessee from 2015 through 2017. Dr. Gazis has published more than 50 peer-reviewed publications, including multiple papers in plant disease, mycologia, fungal biology, and fungal ecology. Since joining the faculty at the University of Florida in 2017, she has mentored and trained more than 20 students, 10 postdocs, and several interns and visiting scholars. Romina is an active member of the American Phytopathological Society, the Mycological Society of America, and the Florida State Phytopathological Society. She has served as member and chair of APS's Tropical Plant Pathology Committee and as a member of APS's Post-Harvest Committees and Forest Pathology Committee. She has also served as Symbiosis and Pathology Counselor for the Mycological Society of America and currently serves as a secretary for the Florida State Phytopathological Society. Romina, welcome to Plantopia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here on the podcast today to learn more about your experiences as a plant pathologist and director of a disease diagnostic clinic at the University of Florida, especially after just returning from your neck of the woods on a family vacation. So I have lots of questions. Before we get into all that, let's go back to the beginning. I want to learn a little bit more about who you are and where you come from and how that shaped your experiences. You're Peruvian, correct?
Correct.
Tell us where in Peru you're from and what life was like growing up there.
Yeah, so I wish I can tell you I am from an exotic place in Peru, like from the Amazon or Cusco or a cool place. But I'm from Lima, Peru, from the capital. And I grew up next to the ocean, which I really adore. So that's one of the reasons I am happy to be here in Florida. I grew up in a beach town, so to speak, and very far away from agriculture. So I never thought in my life that I was going to be working with plants. I thought I was going to be a marine biologist. All my life, lived next to the ocean and like to snorkel and to be doing sports in the ocean. And so I thought that was going to be my life. But then I discovered that I cannot scuba dive because I have a problem in my ear. So I cannot take out the air pressure when I go deep swimming. So that changed things. And I decided to choose my second best, which was mycology, which now is my first best, right? So yeah, that's how I ended up getting into mycology. And that took me into plant pathology. And that took me into this position.
Okay, so you attended Ricardo Palma University. Did I say that correct?
Correct.
That's in Lima. Grew up in Lima or the greater Lima area, which is a pretty big city, like 10 million people or something like that. You majored in biology. Was that a pretty big university?
It was not. It's a known university, and people that go into biology with the idea of going later into ecology or more of the fundamental sciences go to that university. There is another university named La Agraria, which people that want to go into agronomy or agricultural sciences go. So I was, again, on my path to be a marine biologist. So that university, a lot of people that graduate from that university go into the marine sciences.
Okay, but clearly you've got some exposure to mycology. I understand your story of realizing that you couldn't handle diving because of this inner ear issue. Tell me about maybe some meaningful exposure to mycology or microbiology you had there during your time in the university and how that kind of moved you forward.
Yes, the bachelor's degree is a little bit different in Peru. So you have to do 5 years.
Okay.
And you have to take pretty much everything that is out there in biology. So you take protozoology, you take biochemistry 1, 2, 3, physical chemistry, organic chemistry. You have to take a lot of classes.
Right.
And one of them was in the botany branch, which we know it shouldn't be, but you know how it goes. So in that branch, they had a course on ferns and fungi. And so that was not elective. It was a requirement. So we took it. And the teacher was fantastic. And she took us to a region in the kind of cloud forest. And she took us collecting. So that was my first exposure to fungi. And to me, it just looked so much like a coral reef, right? Colorful and hidden, but then when you pay attention, things start popping up. And so I really got into mycology because of that field class. And then when I decided I couldn't dive, which, by the way, you can't be a marine biologist without having to dive. I know that now, but I felt that if I couldn't touch and if I couldn't experience firsthand the organisms that I was going to work with, I didn't want it. So this class really showed me the diversity of mushrooms and how colorful and charismatic they could be, right? So this is how I got into mycology, yeah.
What's really interesting is sometimes I post pictures of fungi on social media, and a lot of marine biologists and marine scientists are like, if you didn't tell me, I would have thought that was from under the ocean. There is this kind of parallel there in terms of the kind of morphology and just the feeling when I've seen pictures of tidal pools and coral reefs. I do get that feeling that I'm in a forest with a lot of brightly colored fungi.
Exactly.
Okay, so you finish your bachelor's degree in 2002, and then you find your way to a similar sized city in Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and attend Texas Christian University, where you study environmental sciences. What specifically were you working on there?
Yeah, so that was an interesting step for me. Another a little bit different thing about university in Peru is that if you want to get your degree, you need to do a thesis. And this is a little bit more than, it requires several months of work. So I got a small scholarship from an NGO to travel to Los Amigos Station in the Amazon and do a inventory of the macro fungi. So that was my bachelor thesis.
Mm-hmm.
While being there, there was it's a large research station. So a lot of people from abroad come to study plants and insects and everything else. So when I finished my inventory, my collection, I went back to Lima to do the microscopy work, and I needed to get some map of the plants. So I was looking for some vegetation maps. And I contacted one of the botanists that had been at the station. And that botanist happened to need a student. So he told me, hey, do you want to come here with a scholarship? I did not know where was Fort Worth, Texas. I had no idea that city existed. And it seemed like a great opportunity. And he was letting me, even though he was studying plants, he was letting me study fungi. So I got that scholarship. I traveled to Fort Worth, beautiful city. And my master thesis was expanding that inventory, but bringing a little bit more of the ecology side. So dividing the station in different habitats and trying to do plots a little bit more in depth than just an inventory. Yeah, like a beta diversity type of study. So I did plots and I understood a little bit about the turnover of decaying fungi and the saprotrophs and the insect associated fungi. So that was my master's thesis.
Just to take a step back, as you're finishing up your bachelor's, even before you made contact with this researcher at Texas Christian University. Did you have interest in pursuing additional education outside of Peru?
I think so. I think I always wanted to do my graduate studies in the U.S. That I was precisely looking for that opportunity when it showed up. I was not. But I always thought that I was going to keep studying, at least at the master's level.
And then at some point, you meet Priscilla, your PhD advisor, and you go on to do a PhD with her at the University of Maryland from 2007 through 2012, which I might add is the exact window of time I was doing my PhD at Penn State, the exact window. How did you meet Priscilla, and tell me how that kind of evolved?
Yeah, that's another story of coincidences. So I was in Texas working with the botanical research called BRIT. That's in Fort Worth, Texas. They have these, they're associated with TCU, with the university. So I was working within botanists. It was a little challenging for me because even though I had support from colleagues that I was contacting by email, I did not have a supervisor or an expert in the university. So that was a little challenging. So I think in one of these several emails that I sent to specialists in the different groups, Priscilla was one of them. And she responded that she wanted to go to Peru to do collections. And I think she just got a seed grant from NSF. So she wanted to go to Peru to collect. And we agreed that I was going to help her with permits. We were going to go together. And then I believe she got pregnant. And so she couldn't go to Peru. So she canceled the trip. So a couple of months passed. I met my future husband when I was in TCU. And so he graduated from his PhD and he moved to Baltimore, Maryland. So I was not yet ready to graduate, but I knew that I had to follow him. And so I was looking where she was at, and she was at Maryland. So I was like, okay, I guess this could be an opportunity. So I contacted her again and we reconnected. And when I visited my fiancé back then, she was at Howard University first. And then we moved to Maryland. And so I interviewed with her and we clicked, and the rest is history. So she had this opportunity to get a student. So that's how I got into Howard. And then we together, we moved to Maryland.
And Priscilla, is she Costa Rican?
Correct.
Okay. Was it always your intention or plan to focus your studies in on the Amazon basin in Peru? Was that kind of, I want to do this, I want to go back, and I want to spend my time in one of the most beautiful spots in Peru?
So even though it seems like my life decisions have been decided for me, or the opportunities have just come, I think my intention was always to work with tropical fungi. Yes, the Amazon is an amazing place to do research, but there are multiple others. I know I like tropical fungi. I like the diversity, a little bit of chaos that you find in these environments. Not that I dislike or I'm not interested in temperate regions. They are beautiful as well. But I always like this constant turnover of species. I think that's what I like, a little bit of chaos, to be honest.
It's funny you say that, because I think about, I fast forward in my mind to your job as a diagnostician and all you're doing, and I'm like, that chaos prepared you for the chaos of the disease clinic. And it's probably true. You postdoc at Clark University with David Hibbett, and then with Janita at UT Knoxville, where you work on thousand cankers disease. Did you have much entomology background before getting to work with the walnut twig beetle and getting into all that beetle-vectored pathogens?
None. So again, in Peru, when you do your bachelor's, you have to take entomology and nematology and things outside your trend. So I had that experience. I'm a taxonomist by nature. So I think that just gives us an advantage when trying to understand other systems. We have the framework already in our minds on how to classify things. Mm-hmm. And I always like entomopathogenic fungi. So I was always drawn to insects, fungal side. So how to kill the insect, or what is killing the insect. And so I'm always fascinated by insects from the fungal perspective of how to manage them. But I did not have any training in beetles, and as they are very difficult to classify, especially ambrosia beetles.
To me, it seems the work at UT Knoxville was really foundational to your current work on another beetle vector disease, laurel wilt. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
It's a very good assessment. Before getting into Knoxville, into Janita's lab, I was working with David on phylogenetics and fungal systematics and unifying a tree of life so we can understand how traits evolved, which is wonderful work. But I think I belong to a more applied side of science. And so I think it was really critical, and I am happy I made that decision to jump from fungal systematics into forest pathology, which is a big jump.
I could appreciate you saying that about the applied side of things. I think one of the great things about doing applied science, I do a lot of work in biocontrol, is it's a real intuitive and easy sell to the general public. You're like, we have this problem. We want to solve it with this solution. And I think that's easier to sell than trying to understand evolutionary history of a gene family. Not that both aren't important, but it's harder to communicate that science to the general public sometimes. One of the other things that kind of caught my attention is that you're from Peru. And I know the biggest, probably most profitable crop in Peru is quinoa. But avocado is a big deal in Peru, too. I think I read Peru is the third largest avocado producer worldwide, including basically the entire coastal region from Ecuador to down to Chile. Was that something that you encountered a lot? Was it a big part of culture in Peru?
Yes, we are a big exporter of avocados. Of course, in comparison to Mexico, we are small. But if you take out Mexico out of that bar graph, we are high there. So we eat avocado every day in my house. It's always there for lunch. That's how you start with a piece of avocado and you put it as a side. We don't really have guacamole or prepare or process avocado. We eat it as a side when you have your lunch. We don't put sugar and we don't drink it as a smoothie or eat it as ice cream. Other countries do. I do not like that. But it is a staple. Definitely people love avocado. We eat a variety called Fuerte. That is different than the Hass. So it has high oil content. And that was really funny because in Florida, we grow the big avocados. I don't know if you saw them.
Yeah.
So they're huge and they are a little bit watery and they are better in salads. They are more like a fresh kind of taste. And so for me, it was really difficult to get into eating local avocados, but because I support my growers and I am definitely behind them, I stopped buying Hass and I only eat tropical Florida avocados when they are in season. And so that was really difficult for me because I'm used to the Hass. My growers produce these huge, more sweet avocados.
Okay, so Lima to Fort Worth, Texas, to College Park, Maryland, to Worcester, Mass, to Knoxville, Tennessee. In 2017, you land a job as assistant professor of plant pathology at the University of Florida Tropical Research and Education Center in Homestead. First off, that's a lot of miles to travel just in the U.S. alone. What attracted you to the position in Florida? Clearly, it wasn't the large avocados based on the conversation we just had. But tell me about what attracted you to the position. I understand that when you're ready to find a job, if the job is posted, that's an attractive feature. But tell me some of the things you found attractive about it.
Yeah, having a job was attractive. But yeah, so I had been a postdoc for almost 5 years and actually a little bit more. I was ready to get a job. And I had interviewed a few times, made it to on-site interview. I think I did well. In hindsight, you realize that you were not right for those positions, right? And it's just so interesting how you see things years after. But I remember feeling defeated right? Because it's been a while and I just wanted to have something more stable. And I was like, okay, this is the last year I'm going to try for university jobs. If not, I will try to get into the industry. I couldn't get into USDA or Forest Service because I was not a citizen. And so I saw the position on a Saturday morning, and I remember telling my husband, they have just posted my dream job. I remember saying those words.
Wow.
And so I applied, and then actually the position was frozen. So they contacted me after having the phone interview, which I guess I passed to the next round. And they contacted me saying that they froze the position and sorry, we'll let you know later if it reopens. So I was like, okay, this is it. But they reopened it and they invited me to come to have an interview, and it was definitely a good fit. It excited me that it had, first, that it was in Florida. It's a one flight back home, 5-hour airplane flight. And of course, it has that tropical environment that I crave. It's next to the ocean, big airport. I check all my boxes. And even though it was for a truly plant pathologist, and I have not been traditionally trained in plant pathology, I thought that my work with endophytes and my knowledge in fungal diversity was good enough to cover the expectations.
Where you are currently in Homestead, is that similar to the climate that was found in Lima and that area of Peru where you grew up?
Not at all. So Lima is very Mediterranean. It's dry. It never rains. So they call it Lima the Gray, Lima la Gris, because it never rains. It's in a rare season that the clouds don't go as high enough to cause precipitation. So it's always cloudy and it's gray. And it's not green at all. And so this here is humid and green and sunny. So it's quite different, but it has the elements that I like when I was collecting fungi for my research during my PhD and my master's, right? It has this diversity of diseases, of crops, and as we were talking before, just the right amount of chaos to keep me on my toes, right?
Tell me how your previous work in mycology prepare you for this role as a diagnostician.
I think this is the way I was able to sell myself. I came and interviewed as a plant pathologist when none of my departments were plant pathology. But my endophyte work was in the time where morphology was still very important. We were doing barcoding, but we were not into metabarcoding yet, right? So we were not doing this microbiome type of studies. We were doing culture work. We were looking and dividing and sorting morphotypes. So learning about morphology of a variety of groups was very important. And so I think that it was key for me to get this position. I'm not afraid of an immense variety of cultures I can push through. I know about very different groups, even from my work at Clark, right, with AB Hibbett. Just going through the phylogenies and all these studies from all these different groups prepare me to know a little bit at least of each group.
I think you bring up an important point is that some of us, but not all of us, are organism-based plant pathologists. That's how I was trained and that's how I train my students. And still to this day, it is really exciting to see all those different fungi come out of those tissues and recognize that. That's an interesting one.
And then you do the reverse taxonomy, right? So you sequence it and then you go back to the culture and then, oh, okay, this is how it looks. So then you start learning from those kind of experiments. But I think a very important thing that I learned through my studies and is useful in my work is how to distinguish saprotrophic fungi, secondary infections, endophytic fungi from the true pathogen, right? And I think that's one of the most challenging things for a diagnostician, because you are giving a plant, who knows where it's coming from, and you are to diagnose what is causing that lesion, what is causing that canker, but but there's going to be a lot of things that come out of that piece of tissue. So my experience with endophytes prepared me to not be, okay, this is Coletotricum, this is Pestalotheopsis, and this is Nigrospora, right? Those can be anything. Like, I call my clinic a village clinic because we do a lot of microscopy, a lot of moist chambers, and a lot of diagnosis based on symptoms and experience and simple tests. So I think that the most challenging things for the people that I try to teach how to diagnose is to decide when something that you see in abundance is not really the primary pathogen.
Yeah.
It's like, why? Why? It's consistently isolated, but so as endophytes, right?
You bring up a good point. It's being able to recognize the things that you can dismiss quickly. It's clear that you deal with a lot of plant pathogens beyond fungi, viruses, bacteria, oomycetes, nematodes. Who has proven the most challenging to work with?
So definitely viruses, just because the techniques to diagnose them are more sophisticated and require more technical experience, right? And we do have some availability to test some of these common viruses, especially in vegetables, but I work on ornamentals and tropical fruits. For those kind of hosts, there are not a lot of easily to use immune strips that you can run a test. However, the producer don't really need to know exactly which virus is infecting the crop. They need to know how it's transmitted, right? Because you're going to address the vector, not the virus. I'm not doing any pest identification. What I do need to know is how to recognize the pest damage so I can refer the plant to the entomologist. On the other hand, we do need to know which viruses we have, right? Because it's a matter of plant protection. They can be new viruses. If there's something that I haven't seen before, then I have the support of the State Department and there's a virologist. So I send the samples to them. Now, I would like to implement some diagnostic tests just because I want the grower to be more proactive, right? And a lot of the crops, especially passion fruit, dragon fruit, those are propagated through cuttings. So when you have that kind of propagation, then you can also propagate viruses if the mother plant has the viruses.
Right.
So I am trying to give the message of clean plants, but if I don't have the testing capacity to offer them, sometimes I get into this issue.
Do you have growers reach out to you saying, hey, look, I'm seeing ring spot on my fruits. Could you come take a look? Or do you just have them send a sample once they identify, okay, you taught us about ring spots and I'm seeing it. What do I do now?
That depends, right? If this is a large grower and I will ask first for photos, because sometimes what a symptom is for you is not for the other person. And so they send photos. I can go to the field. I would rather them submit a sample so we can do the testing and then go to the field. Sometimes if it's something that we haven't seen before, I am there the next day just to be sure we get a good sample and then we can speed the process. But yeah, it's everything in between. It can be from somebody just bringing a sample to me going to the field, helping with a sample collection.
I know viruses have their own challenges, but let's take a fungal disease or a bacterial disease. Why don't you take us through a workflow of a grower reaching out and saying they have, you know, maybe a suspected leaf spot or lesions on fruit. Tell me how that sample goes from them to you through being processed.
We are a walk-in clinic. So 80% of the samples that we receive at the clinic is a grower or a producer just going through the doors and bringing a sample. And so once they bring the sample, my lab technician will intake the sample. There is a submission form where they can put all the information on the host, the variety. This is very important, even though it sounds like I should be able to know what plant they are submitting. In the case of ornamentals, you have all these different varieties and some of them look off. And so sometimes I don't know how the normal plant should look, right? I probably go to the clinic 2-3 times a day and look what samples we have on the table. And then I talk with the lab tech and we decide which tests we need to run. And most of the samples are going to be tested based on the symptoms, right? If we see water-soaked lesions, it should go for bacteria isolation. We always look at the roots anyways, because we have a lot of problems with Phytophthora. So we always look at the roots. We always do microscopy and some immunostrips to test for Ralstonia or Phytophthora. And then let's say that we do bacteria tests, then we have to isolate the bacteria. And then we do HR, so hypersensitive response on tomatoes. We have our list of susceptible tomato varieties, and that's what we do. And based on the results, we write a report. Those reports vary in their recommendations based on the client. And so we don't only provide diagnosis, and we include a little bit of the biology of the pathogen.
Do you do 16S and ITS sequence confirmation on all your cultures?
No. Again, the grower wants to know if they have bacteria, so they stop spraying fungicides or miticides or insecticides. It's to that level. Now, there are some growers that they do want to know which bacteria they have, because perhaps they are a bigger operation and they know that some bacteria are becoming less sensitive to certain pesticides. And so for those cases, we do 16S if they request it. For the fungal infections, it will depend. So let's talk about Fusarium wilt of Canary date palms. We have these beautiful Canary date palms, which give you a Mediterranean kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
They are very expensive. A grown Canary date palm can be $10,000, $50,000. And they get Fusarium wilt quite often, and that's a lethal disease. And the symptoms sometimes are not so distinctive, right? And there's another fungus, Phomopsis, that causes also rachis blight. And Fusarium is everywhere, right? So when you grow, you can have Fusarium. It can be consistent, and the symptoms can match. But you need to run the PCR specific for Fusarium wilt, because the recommendation will be to dispose of the palm.
And if you're telling someone to cut down a $20,000 tree, you better be sure that you're right.
Exactly. So we do have a list of diseases that need to be confirmed through PCR.
That makes sense. What's the weirdest or worst sample you ever received?
One day we got a sample with a snake inside.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it only happened once. I am actually surprised it has only happened once. And it was very scary. We do get some smelly samples. I don't know if you have experienced this, but fermented palm tissue smells really bad. And the smell just lingers inside the lab.
Yeah, I haven't smelled a fermented palm, but southern blight samples, like you get like a squash with like southern blight, and it just, oh, it turns so rancid. It's awful. I think our listeners might be interested in hearing about your favorite fungus. Do you have a favorite fungus?
I do. That's cordyceps, always.
Okay.
From the beginning until now. And I do work with Tolipocladium. We are actually working on a project together. Mm-hmm. And that's Elaphocordyceps. So that's in the group that I like. There's nothing most beautiful than a cordyceps emerging from an ant.
Yeah, for sure. Love those Ophiocordyceps for sure. So how do you not get distracted from really cool samples with like weird or rarely seen fungi? I know that you just don't have the time to go off on a tangent, and maybe time itself is the thing that keeps you from going off track, but there must be occasions where you're just like, I'm going to spend a couple hours at the scope looking at this because it's so bizarre.
It happens all the time. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges for me, because I'm really passionate about this fungi. And I love doing microscopy, and I love to just dig into certain samples that come in. And at the beginning, I wanted to save every culture because someday I was going to do something. And I started a collection. I very quickly learned that that was not sustainable. I cannot save cultures. And that's pretty sad, actually, because I could be collaborating with so many people, getting all these fungi and populations, and there's such a pressure from pesticides, from heat, from just imagine how informative that would be. So I learned really quickly that was not sustainable. Sometimes I do spend more time than I should under the microscope taking photos, and I don't know how many photos I have of Tiella biopsis. I have seen it multiple times, but it still fascinates me. So I think that's a big challenge, especially for me, because I get distracted quite easily and I enjoy that. So I would rather have to work extra hours during the weekends and after hours and holidays just to be able to spend a little bit of time with what I want to do, right? If I was really efficient, I should finish my work within working hours. But I don't. But I think I have this extra time to have this joy of looking at more samples. But one of the things that I did is moving away from the clinic. So I used to have my office inside the clinic building. And every time a mango grower will come and say, I have 20 trees, this is happening, I will step out and talk to the grower. Every time a tropical fruit grower with more than one tree dying, I would just be with my ear. And so I had to request an office outside the building because I couldn't just not be involved. But it's difficult.
Right. That's some discipline there. I get it. Now, yeah. At the University of Florida, you develop and deliver bilingual education materials and activities. What percentage of your growers and the large general public there communicate with you and your clinic primarily in Spanish?
Yeah, so in terms of the clinic, I would say that 70% of the clients speak Spanish. And I would say perhaps 30 only Spanish.
Okay.
My lab is bilingual. Actually, most of us are Hispanic. So I have different cohorts through time. But as for now, the one that is currently residing in my lab are mainly from Colombia. And so they do speak both languages. There are some growers, again, that only speak Spanish. So we do have to explain the reports and the recommendations in Spanish. I do give workshops in both languages. So usually I deliver them in English and they have a different session in Spanish. So it's a big part of my program, and I think I have been able to succeed because I speak Spanish and I'm able to deliver this knowledge to the growers. And we build a relationship, right? And they trust me. Sometimes people like to hear things on their own language. I think that has benefited me quite a bit.
And I assume that some of the other extension faculty and there at the University of Florida are also bilingual and speak Spanish. So that burden doesn't fall solely on your shoulders for putting together these educational materials?
It is very interesting because we also have a large Asian community of growers. So mm-hmm. people that grow passion fruit, dragon fruit are either Hispanic or Asian. So we do have extension specialists or faculty here at the station that are from China, from Taiwan. It's funny, sometimes we are in the field and it's myself, the horticulturist, which is American, and the other pathologist, he's from China. So the three of us are trying to talk to the growers, and sometimes the owner of the farm is Chinese, and then some of the workers are Hispanics. So we really complement each other in terms of discipline and in terms of culture to facilitate that communication, because it's not only the language, right? It's just a culture and a way to approach a problem.
It seems like that having bilingual lab members is a big part of your lab identity and lab culture. Is that a fair assessment?
It helps for sure, but I don't think it's a requirement.
We've talked a lot about your extension and diagnostic work. You do a lot of research, and I know that there's some overlap there. but I thought I'd give you an opportunity to tell us about something you're currently working on that you're excited about.
Yeah, so as my life is, it's driven by avocado research. I do other type of research and other topics, which I love, but definitely my life is dedicated to study laurel wilt of avocado, which is the most important threat to avocado production in our area, and it's on the move. And so it will be a problem in other areas as well. So I am working now on a project that is trying to use trichoderma as a biological control of laurel wilt. It is not the conventional biological control that we think, that we go to the center of origin and we look for natural enemies. Mm-hmm. These are strains that have been locally isolated. So they are used to the heat, humidity, soil diversity, lack of soil of South Florida. And I am trying to now make them endophytic again. So I have isolated them from scape trees. So trees that have recovered from the disease or are not showing a lot of symptoms from that disease. And so I have isolated those trichodermas from inside the trees. I have tested in vitro. They do inhibit the growth of the pathogen. Now I'm trying to put them back into the system. Avocados are hardwoods. So it's very complicated. It's going to take a lifetime, probably. But every step is so rewarding that it's worth investigating. So that's what I'm excited about. We are having good results in introducing again certain strains, and we are able to inoculate the avocado seeds and then isolate the trichoderma from the leaves once they sprout. Now we need to know if they are going to behave that way in terms of producing these metabolites that can inhibit the growth of the pathogen while they are inside the plant, right? We don't know until we challenge those plants with the pathogen. So that's what we are doing now.
And so far, that relationship, once you isolate them from the leaves, they're pretty stable inside that plant. They won't be supplanted by something else or be kicked out by something.
That's one of the challenges, because we know about these endophytes, right? Again, it goes back to my endophyte work. The plants or the treatments that use non-endophytic trichoderma, when you plate those leaf tissues, they are full of coletotrichum, full of them. Fungi are very territorial, right? I really think that it's a matter of letting the trichoderma colonize the tissue first will give advantage to the strain that we are trying to use. So certain strains have been able to colonize systemically the seedling, the plant. Now we don't know how stable that will be through the plant development. So that we'll have to wait years to see if that plant, when it's put in the field, will remain being colonized by trichoderma. So that's what we are thinking. The development of a biological control agent takes at least 10 years. I think that's the average. So it's going to take a long time. However, if we discover that this trichoderma produces some peptides and that's the mode of action, then we can synthesize those and use a spray. You can always deviate a little bit from that path that you are taking and discover little things that may be more applicable in the short term. So that's how I see this project.
You were in the Galapagos Islands recently. Do you want to tell us briefly like what you were doing there?
Yeah. So I always wanted to go to the Galapagos like any other biologist, right? But I wanted to go to work. I did not want to take a cruise. I wanted to go and do research. Mm-hmm. I was contacted by somebody in the Doctor in Plant Medicine program of UF, which is pretty much plant doctors. There was a Ecuadorian student that was working on finding natural enemies of an invasive ant, a fire ant. Solenopsis geminata is a fire ant, invasive to the islands, but it's native to mainland. So it's native to South America. And it causes a lot of damage, not only to local, like it's displacing native ants, but it's also attacking baby turtles and baby birds. And they have these conservation programs that have documented that these ants will bite the baby turtles and baby birds and then kill them because they attack them in mass. So anyway, so it's very important from the conservation point of view and from the agricultural point of view because it's a nuance for farmers. So I was invited to look for natural enemies in fungi and bacteria from these ants. And so let me tell you, these are fire ants. They sting. And we have a lot in Florida. And there is another species that is even worse than that fire ant. And so I know the problem. I have suffered from stings from these ants in the field constantly. So I know they are a nuance and they need management. Growers spend a lot of money managing those ants. So I was happy to integrate that as part of my program. However, these are social insects, so they clean themselves really well. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to find any kind of fungi or bacteria that could be affecting the colonies because they can recognize who is sick and they take the bodies and the sick ants out of the colony. Anywho, I found myself in Galapagos opening fire ant nests and looking for queens and allied ants. And so I collect them, swap them, homogenize them, plate them, and get the fungi and bacteria while my colleagues are trying to find some decapitating wasps that could be used as a natural enemy. So we are looking for natural enemies, different groups of organisms, yeah, in the Galapagos Islands. I've been there twice, and it's been just wonderful.
That's really exciting. It also speaks to this larger theme of you seeking out chaos to keep yourself going. Maybe I should go dig up some fire ant nests and see what happens.
Exactly.
We're about out of time here, so I really appreciate you making the time. I really enjoyed having you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you.
We've just heard from Dr. Romina Gazis, Associate Professor of Plant Pathology at the University of Florida. As always, be sure to check out the show notes section immediately following the episode description for links related to Romina's work. I'm Matt Kasson, host of Plantopia. Thanks for listening.